Welcome to the latest episode of High Stakes. I'm Paige Soya, Managing Director of K Street Capital. And today's episode is going to be all about Mei Shi and her exit of her last company. So before we get started, Mei, maybe give a little bit of an introduction and your background, and then we can talk a little bit about the exit of your last company.
Excellent. I have been an entrepreneur many times. I would say a serial entrepreneur. I started my first business, Chesapeake Bay Candle, in 1994. I always joke that Andy Warhol and I had a lot in common in that we both started with Campbell's Soup, canned. Obviously, he went on to become a rich and famous, you know, defining artist of the century. And I'm still making candles. So I think that's where our destinies are different. I was not actually trained to be in that business. I was trained while growing up in China as a diplomat. I was one of the first group of 12-year-old enrolled in a diplomatic immersion program back in 1979 after Nixon opened what would be called the week that changed the world, that changed the relations between US-China, and China quickly realized that they don't have a lot of Korean diplomats that understand languages as well as have enough history behind them. So like many things the country do, they decided to wholesale produce them. And starting at a very young age, so I was 12, along with many 12-year-olds in my city, after being selected for academics and merits, to join 79 other kids. And we'll focus on English, I remember German, French, or Japanese for 6 years. So we have an immersion program where we learn the language. We also learn their history, culture, world affairs in the language that we're learning, which is in 1979 is pretty exceptional.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, what even more interesting, Paige, is that we will have native speakers coming to teach us. Those were the days when I think the world is so curious. So you have missionaries, you have college professors that want to teach in China so that they can travel there and really demystify the country. So I was really trained as a diplomat continually in Beijing. After the 6 years, I went on to the best education for foreign affairs in Beijing Foreign Studies University, during which time I started to be tapped to translate for the World Bank when they started their investment in China. And I really loved it. But unfortunately, I graduated in 1989, which is where Tiananmen Square happened. I don't think most people in the US or the Western world know, but all the students in big cities, when they graduate that year, and I was unfortunately graduating in July of that year, we were all sent out of the cities so that even if we were offered jobs temporarily for a year, we were all sent out to farms, factories, military camps so that we get re-educated.
Oh my gosh.
To avoid another riot.
That must have been absolutely miserable for you, especially after going through all of that training and all of that promise, what your career could have been.
Absolutely. You know how if you don't speak a language for a few months, it gets rusty. And I was just completely devastated. And I was dating at that time, and I just felt really like isolated in a whole different way. I was looking after warehouses for export, and it was a commodity. Yeah. Which is minerals. And every day I have only deal with two trucks picking up their loads. And that's the whole intensity of the day. And there's no intellectual stimulation or entertainment. So I was bored to death. So I resigned back in 1989. That was suicidal in the system, in that you're basically signing yourself off the system. You're betraying the education you're getting. So I knew that I couldn't find anything else in China, and I decided to study my graduate school. So long story short, I didn't really find a good job after I graduated because of the war. The bank was not hiring. The World Bank was heavily funded by United States. But when United States was in the first war with Iraq, they didn't pay their dues. So they're not hiring temporarily. Yeah. Everything for my graduation twice always seemed to be like not aligned. So found a very boring job in New York. And it was so boring that I ended up entertaining myself at Bloomingdale's next week.
I love
and
that.
How I saw the difference of fashion and home fashion. And I told my then husband every day how home fashion was not contemporary, has not the style that fashion itself has already arrived at. And it's contemporary, it's clean, it's not clustered. And why is that? So that's how I started the business, 1994. And focusing on candles.
Yeah. I mean, it's really an incredible journey. I mean, you probably learned, as miserable as it was being around those factories and understanding how they operate, ended up probably being sort of helpful to the ultimate business that you had for almost 20 years, right?
Yeah, I think that business I ran since 1994, and our exit was in 2017. So it's more than 20 years. And yeah, I mean, I was growing up in a factory. My dad was an engineer, and he's in charge of a group of engineers, about 200 of them. So it was always very clear to me how that world is very functional by organization. There's tiers of things. But I never really thought that would be my destiny. So I could have been more careful. What I think really helped me was the fact that China was becoming the big machine to produce for the world. I could not tell you how I have so many friends that instead of working in foreign affairs, ended up being tapped to lead foreign trade for China. So they working to export initially a lot of OEM for fashion. You would see Donna Karen's clothing there. You would see the knitwear for Calvin Klein. It's really a booming time for them. And they were very easy to work with because they are so hungry. There are millions and millions of people waiting to find jobs. So the doors were wide open. And when we gave them ideas, they were so receptive. So I do feel we were at the beginning of China becoming the world factory. And that timing itself is probably the biggest catalyst for our success.
That makes a ton of sense. So when you sold your company in 2017, this is Chesapeake Bay Candle Company, how big was it? How much of a stake did you have? Who bought it? I mean, I know it's public, but maybe we can just talk about that for a second.
It's all public. We sold it to Newell Brands, which is a public company, a conglomerate that holds maybe 50 consumer product companies. So they have Yankee Candle, which is very noticeable as the leader of home fragrance. They have Woodwick. But they also have a lot of Sharpie pen, you know, it's one of their brand. They have the glue, Elmo glue, for example. They have strollers, they have pots and pans. So I think they are a $14 billion company that really controls a lot of what's available at Target and Walmart and Amazon. So we were, you know, we were doing great business. I would say around $65 million maybe at that time. And it was a good valuation. We sold for 75 cash, all cash deal.
All cash. That's incredible.
And I think, you know, we own 100%. I've never really had any investors.
I was going to say, you didn't have any investors or any.
I remember we made a mistake of having investor first, asking for investment in China. Mm-hmm. And we tell them what we do and they say, so you're making candles. And we say, yes, we make candles. And they say, and then what do you do with the candles? And then I laughed and I said, okay, I don't think you're going to invest it.
Ask
questions because I think they must be asking. And you use them when there's no lights. And then you blow them out when the light came back. And you are telling us there's a lot of potential and multiples in them. No. I think Asian firms in particular, I was actually having this conversation with someone on the West Coast recently. I said, they really don't understand candles in particular, or home space, as much they understand maybe fashion, because it's more out there, right? There's more skin in the game for consumers, and there's more sharing of their stories. So yeah, I mean, we tried, and when that was our answer, we ended up not going, but we borrowed initially, very heavily. But then I was able to open the doors to, you know,
yeah,
some Bloomingdale, for example, and once
right
invoices from those stores, the banks are happy to lend you, right? And we were very good at profitability. And I'm just telling you, from the first, we started in September of 1994. And by the end of the year, we made $500,000 of sales and we were profitable.
Wow. So you were profitable from the very beginning.
From the very beginning.
A rare type of business.
Yeah, I know. And we borrowed money. We always have an open line of credit with Bank of America. I'm laughing at myself because I have not left. I've still had all my accounts with them. It's a funny thing that it all happened that way. We were too busy to even ask for a different rate, for interest. They were right there next to our warehouse office. So it just happened. Now,
right.
The predominant bank, that was almost 30 years ago.
Wow. So when you sold it in 2017, what was the market environment like at that time? I mean, just to remind people who might have not been around in the investing space that year.
They were born in 2000 and they were still babies. I think, you know, the condition at that time is that the market is pretty rich in terms of multiples. Not so much for consumer product, but extremely rich for growth companies with brands, with ideas, and particularly, as you and I know, in the technology field, right? You don't even
have
a business like us. You could just be an idea. I remember sitting on the investment board of a venture fund, and I remember writing checks for 10 times of what the first invoice they have, you know, just so that we can get in. And we are rushing to write that check so that they agree we can invest in them. So that was probably the peak of the venture rushing after ideas. I know it's been very hard since COVID, particularly now that the interest rate is so high. So
yes.
It was very low interest environment at the same time. So
It's important for people to realize that the timing, the only two things that really matter in investing is what the timing of when you got in and the timing of when you got out, right? So that's where all the returns.
I can really time it. I don't know if I ever told you, Paige, but I got into this by really, it's a very unfortunate accident. I was actually consulted to do a due diligence for, did I tell you the story?
I don't think so.
So you and I haven't caught up on that one. So I was friendly with a guy at Carlyle. As you know, they do a lot of consumer mergers and acquisitions. And they bought PartyLight. PartyLight is one of the largest. I would say they're probably at that time right after Yankee Candle. But they do those parties where women will like introduce candles to their friends. And they do business.
Got it.
We have a factory in Cincinnati. They are the good old, you know, success story for direct to consumer. But somehow, you know, in the 2000 and after, I think Yankee started opening stores. They never really get around to do that. And I think they just didn't work out. So at some point, Carlyle was doing a due diligence and they interviewed me for that. And I was giving pretty good, obviously, feedbacks about the market, who the drivers of the market is, you know, where the innovation coming from, where the consumer is. And they really liked that recommendation. After all, afterwards, they did acquire PartyLight. And then, right, maybe 3-4 months afterwards, they came around and say, now that we settled with them, we are actually interested in acquiring you.
Ah, so funny. And so that all came out of...
kind of expected. I was expecting that because, you know, I know that I've around the block, I've been chased before. We chased people before. So I know what that dance kind of looked like. So we invited their factory director to come visit us. And I went to visit them. And I was going through thinking about what to do when I discovered I had breast cancer late 2016. And it was early stage, but it's very aggressive.
Oh.
And I was told I need to have a surgery and 6 months of chemo. And then radiation. So I was really shocked. My kids are still in school, I think in middle school. And I was just like, you know, I'm a single mother at that time. I really can't think of what's more important to me. And clearly, my business is my firstborn, so I need to protect it. And I also feel because my oldest is going to be about time to apply to college, I'm really thinking about all of them like they have to graduate. You know, that's the way I look at my business and say, maybe it is time for my business to graduate, just like I'm going to graduate. And he's on the process of looking at schools. And ironically, they're all coming at the same time. So I said, let me graduate my company so that it's not relying on me. If something happened to me, we'll have a proper process for it. So I did run a process, you know.
Okay. You had a banker and you looked at different.
So I have to say, anyone is a consumer and anyone is wanting to find a partner, I'm always going to say there are a few really good names, right? C.D. Cohen is one of them. They're very much on the luxury side. But I really like to work with Jay Eastman, who is at Raymond James. And now they're also part of another firm. And I know Vanessa very well at the firm that they're combined. All of a sudden, I can't remember. I'll remember. I'll bring it up to you. Or you may be able to find it. They recently worked with another company as investment firm for consumer business. But Raymond James is very strong. Jay Eastman is actually based in Baltimore. And he goes to work right away. So I think I met him in March of 2017. And we started writing our book while I was getting treatment. I remember my hairs were falling off. And I was running the business. I told everybody, but I was wearing a wig. And my team was so supportive. I have to say, it is probably the best way to actually do chemotherapy is when you're selling the company, because it's so distracted. You know, I remember taking one of the management calls when I was doing chemo. Right?
Oh, wow. At the hospital.
At the hospital. Those were the days without Zoom, right? So it's really a phone call. It was an international buyer. So I'm thinking back. It's kind of a blur because it happened really fast. Because the driver wants very fast closing, I remember. And everything has to happen really fast. But before even that management call, which is in the summer, every weekend, I remember, I don't have time during a weekday, or I'm too tired, or the chemo is so uncomfortable. I couldn't do it. But it's always the weekend. My team and I work on the deck, work on the book. It was a team spirit. And I really felt that the whole company came to this process with me, hoping that they have the best results, that their work gets to be continued. They get a new shot of possibility at growth. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of messaging and this chemistry that we developed during that time. It was incredible.
I can't imagine the stress of going through an exit while going through chemo. It's stressful enough to go through an exit at all. You know, I mean, the emotions are
I feel anybody who has done that, Paige. But in a way, like I said, it helped me get through the chemo because it's like my biggest concern is I can't finish my job with this kid. And now I feel I'm motivated, right, to find a good home for this or good university, as I usually say, so that it can grow.
And so your team was happy about the idea of selling it, and they were happy with the transaction. And they talk to me a little bit about that, like post transaction. Did you have handcuffs? How long did you stay? Was your team happy?
I don't think anybody really know. A lot of them have had experiences. I actually have a lot of people coming from the merchandising side of Macy's. As you know, we have lost our own department store in Hacks and Woolworth. And so there are a lot of people that used to work in that industry that doesn't have a place to go. And, you know, Chesapeake Bay provided them a job that's on the other side of the fence, but very creative, right? And they can apply what they learned. So it was a great team that I have. I can't tell you how lucky I am, because a lot of them actually came here because their husband found a job and they never thought they could find anything like that here in the capital, because it's more political jobs or lawyers or defense industry. So I have a very passionate group of people. And honestly, they're mixed feelings, right? Because they know how when Macy's lay off the whole group. It feels really, it doesn't. So they have mixed feelings. They know that I'm looking for someone not to just do mergers and acquisitions. That's why when Carlyle came, I wasn't as excited because I know it's a 3-year, you know, horizon that we have to perform. Right. So I'm rather happy that we have more than just financial investors. We have, you know, companies such as Newell Brands that wants to hold the business, wants to grow the business, and
exactly.
Already in, you know, a sector knowledge for it.
So did the buyers know you were going through chemo? Did you try to keep that sort of?
I told my lawyer, and because it's very early stage and I'm working the whole time, so they didn't have expectations for me to continue working for long anyway. They were hoping, and they told me to stay for 1 year because it's like cash 100% transaction. And I did. And I worked with the CEO at that time of the division very closely. She was lovely. And we traveled together to London, where they have a big European office for home fragrance. And I introduced the collection to them, the brand to them. We got everybody very excited. So we had a very amicable relationship. Obviously, what happened later is always part of the mergers and acquisition plan. I think they closed the office and closed the factory that I put in Maryland as the first factory 3 decades, and they moved everything to Massachusetts. That is not what I was hoping for, I have to say, but I understand when you manufacture, you want scale and you want scale to create value, right? So that's unfortunate for the factory team. But I think everybody kind of understand, I'm in a rock and a hard place at that time.
Of course. And I guess if we're thinking about, you know, going through that whole process and that transaction beginning to end, is there anything you wish you had done differently or that you knew? I mean, it was your first exit, right? So, you know, first time running through that process. And
I have to say that it's my exit, but I was courting this a few times before. Way back, maybe in early 2005, for whatever reason, I was introduced to L'Occitane. I'm sure you know, they're a French brand with creams and bath and body. And the thing about L'Occitane that many people did not know is that they're very international because they listed their stock in Hong Kong.
Okay.
And to know their CEO, who's a French guy, and we were talking about strategic relations. L'Occitane has always been very much a heritage company. You know, they are from Provence and they are very proud of the lavender fields, you know, all the fragrances there. And they understand our business really well. At some point, they were thinking about acquiring some kind of shares or 100% because for their business, they didn't have a significant fragrance business. You know, they have a very good bath and body, even shampoo. But for whatever reason, they have only like 1 or 2 candles and they wonder if that is a mistake or miss. And in hindsight, if you look at other similar companies, I can tell you, this is public knowledge, Bath and Body Works in the US, 50% of their income is from home fragrance. So you would see the potential could have been or close to 50%, maybe 40%, right? But very high margin, extremely, also attract a lot of consumers there because the seasonality makes people shop more frequently. Right? I mean, you need to finish the bath, you know, lotion maybe in half a year, where literally you can finish burning a candle if you want to in a week.
Right.
Well, when you think about consumables and how people use fragrance, it's a lot more frequent home fragrance than, let's say, a soap or a shampoo. So looking back, I wish I had that kind of confidence to tell him that, yeah, you know, indeed, you have a global retail operation also at all the premium duty-free shops. That's a great opportunity to introduce fragrance, not just fine fragrance, but really fragrance as a gift, you know, fragrance, full of fragrance. So I wasn't established enough, I would say. I haven't been investing individually at companies myself, to have that language, I would say probably the wisdom, or maybe ask a few other people to sort of sounding off those. I didn't hire a banker for sure, right? So it was a very direct conversation. And I highly recommend anybody who wants to sell their business never to trust that kind of relationship. The one-on-one seldom works out for your best interest because you don't have the scale to screen out those who has the potential for you. It sounds very attractive. You're eliminating the middleman. You go direct, but you are only talking to one.
It's true. That's absolutely true. It's a good point. I guess after 2005, you started doing investing. Obviously, you're a K Street investor, a good friend of mine, and LP and everything else, but you've made lots of investments along the way, even before we met. Did that sort of inform you as well as like having a banker and going through a proper banking process when you sold? But like, had you been investing before that yourself, so you knew sort of the other side of the table enough?
Yeah, I think more and more, you know, I have always been fortunate to have a financial advisor. So I usually don't get involved until when I was divorced. Honestly, I got divorced like in the late, you know, 2015. And that's when 2012, 2013, I was in the process of really thinking about my finance. And that's the moment where I started to pay more attention. I think that's another problem with women. We have so much confidence in our partners. And we know we're not like happy with doing that. I'm always a front person. I'm always marketing. I love design. I love being the creative person. So sometimes you just leave that sort of as someone you trust, right? And you're not in finance all the time. The idea of investing, the idea of selling your company is almost a little scary. Mm-hmm. It's like, let me just avoid that. Someone else is going to take care of that. And I founders, it's the biggest problem. You have to face that fear head on, and you have to be a financial person at some point.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
Doesn't mean you do all the financial fine details. It just means you have to have your eyes on the price early, rather than avoiding that. I know a lot of founders sold their business like when they have to retire and they have to do a fire sale.
Right. Exactly. Like,
yeah, when I got sick, right? So I feel the mentality has to be more, there is never a perfect time for sale or for investment, other people to invest in your business. It's really how you want to structure it. And it's a very transparent, very easy to understand process if you allow yourself to think of it.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's easier than people realize. It's just getting over that fear and being willing to open your mind to learn about it. Right. Then you can understand it.
Adding other people into your life, right? Mm-hmm. That's probably the thing that for me was the hardest now, because I haven't had to run a business with another company ever or another investor. So that kind of gives me a little bit of a second.
Absolutely. So I want to switch gears a little bit on this final piece here, which is after you sold the company, you started doing other things. Like, I think you're sort of one of those people that never is quite finished, and you started another business and you started a lot of other things, but we'd love to hear about what you're doing now and just share that journey, because I think for a lot of founders after an exit, you don't even know who you are anymore, and you kind of have to like figure that out.
Yeah. Well, I'm still figuring that out. I sometimes just think I'm too busy. Like, how come I'm still, you know, working so many hours a week?
Right.
Can my husband and I want to take off somewhere, and we always have to check our calendars and nothing is available. So it's still a puzzle to me, but I know myself. I don't think I'm the kind that can officially retire. I think we're always in this sort of semi taking time a little bit mood, but not 100%, right? I'm going to challenge myself to do a little bit more relaxing and a little bit less working if possible. But I always want to say that the first passion of mine is to see an idea and then be able to see that it actually become a reality. That is the satisfaction nothing can replace. As an entrepreneur, I'm never the person that just give a vision. I always know how long this idea is going to take at what cost. Mm-hmm. And like that process, it's really a journey, right? I know the word is used so often by so many, but to us, the product idea to seeing it in the store is satisfying. And then seeing people commenting it, and not just one kind of person. It's like from the customers, from the retailers, from the investors, you know, that's what excites me. So it's creating things from scratch. So recently, during COVID, as you know, everybody was staying at home. And obviously, the whole idea of COVID and the sense of smell come hand to hand, right? For the first time, people may want to think twice when they say, there's one sense you can live without. What would that be? It won't be, oh, my sense of smell. I can sacrifice that. Used to be, that would be the first thing people say they can live without.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely not vision. They can't stand, they can't listen to music, but they can stand not smelling things until they really lose it.
Mm-hmm.
And the world all of a sudden become very strange, right? There's can't taste the onion, can't taste the curry. That must be very painful because your sense of taste, there is only five. The bitter, the sweet, the sour, the salty, and the umami, right? That's the Japanese word. Everything else is your sense of smell. That's how the world comes to you, and that's how you enjoy your food. So when you don't smell, not only you don't smell the roses, you also don't smell all your food. So people really started to realize, oh, maybe the sense of smell is more important than I thought. Maybe I need it because I can't even smell my dog. I certainly can't smell if my baby has had a bad, you know, diaper change that
Good
I didn't
point.
Or you know, there's a fire or my gas is burning and I didn't know this, right? That could be dangerous. So I was thinking about that and I was thinking, that's interesting. Finally, the whole education that we always wanted about your sense of smell is out there. No one's doing anything. We just know that's a sign of not good health, but we don't know what else to do. So that's when I decided that I want to go back to what I love.
Yeah.
And I looked around to see anybody interested in this business. Not many, because, you know, we're living in a world where everybody's chasing what's obvious for influencers, AI. No, Bitcoin was the rage.
Right.
I had the Bitcoin. Why would anybody talk about diaper smell and, you know, what does it mean to them? So that I started that maybe just not about any fragrance. I think when I think about myself as a busy mother and a busy, you know, executive and mother, I always wanted something that immediately can calm me down. Or immediately, you know, I have no patience. So immediately I smell it, I kind of can't focus. And interestingly, science do support there is such a thing, and it's called fragrance, right? I don't know if you realize things take place immediately, right?
Like, I realized this only from you, May. I learned this from you, and then I did my own research, and now I'm like a full believer. I think a lot of people don't know this, though. It's a new era.
You and I have this common friend who made the supplement for food, right? And people know how much you can take certain things so that you feel better. So this whole idea that we humans have to take care of ourselves, not waiting when we have an illness to go to see the doctor.
Right.
Becoming more and more urgent, right? I think COVID again is where people think about that. So the fact that apothecary took off is also because this whole self-care. And I feel fragrance is one of the many ways we can self-care. And why not in a pleasant way? Not just
exactly
bitter herbs, but also enjoying roses when you can feel renewed, or smelling some eucalyptus so that beginning of your day, you can focus. So that's what I did, which I launched actually late last year at Bloomingdale. It's called Bloom Me. And if anybody wants to check it out on our website, it's bloomefragrance.com. I was actually just there. They loved the container that it was so...
I loved the container.
Yeah. It's just... It was just something that, Paige, I'm so happy. It's my aesthetic. Finally, remember, I was at Bloomingdale's more than 30 years ago and say, why is everything so ornate and so gilded, and I want something simple and and fresh.
Yes.
And exactly. Speak more to something that is about fragrance. You don't want the vessel to take away from that. So anyway, that's what I'm doing now. And we were fortunate to be launching with Bloomingdale's and soon at Saks.
Yes. That's so exciting. Congratulations.
So and exciting. Yes.
Exciting to be doing it all over again. You know, it's like you had that journey and you just, you never give up in your mind and your spirit, and you're on to this other thing. It's really cool.
Well, I hope that there's more that I can share, but we are recently teaming up with NIH to go back to the question of loss of smell for consumers. So there will be more product and services to launch in the partnership there. So I'm very excited.
Very cool. I know you're so busy putting it all together, but it's really cool to see the reality of it. And well, thank you so much for being willing to share all of this and just your honesty and the authenticness of the story. It's, I think a lot of people can learn from hearing that. Every exit is different, you know, and that.
Very different. The circumstances are different, but I hope the message is very clear. There's never a good time to really sell your business. Just be prepared, find opportunity, and talk to a lot of people. You know, don't be afraid.
And don't be afraid of it.
I offer my help if anybody wants to chat about their journey.
That's very cool. Thank you. And that's a wrap for today's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. And if you enjoyed it, please leave us a rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. Thanks.